But everybody is highly motivated. One of the books I read on this subject a few years ago was written by a Jewish psychologist who devoted his entire first chapter to describing the condition of Adam and Eve in the garden and how they got turned out. Then he said that man's primary motivation since that time had been to regain the ease that existed in Eden. So probably the greatest motivation that we have is the pursuit of ease. Now, would you say that someone who sleeps 12 hours a day is highly motivated? You would? Yeah. How about somebody who watches television for 6 hours? Are they motivated? So really, what the subject is, our real concern, is a change of motivation. As I said, we start on the premise that everybody is motivated. And when we speak of people being motivated, we really mean what is needed is a change of motivation. Now, my studies into this subject have been very encouraging. One of the encouraging things is that regardless of age, background, or experience, it's possible for any person to make a revolutionary change in motivation. There is no hindrance or barrier to accomplishing all the change that's wanted and needed. Motivation involves a personality change. So a person can have a change of personality at any period in their life. How old was Jacob when he finally got out into business before God? Do you remember? Anybody know? Yes, how old was he? When he had his experience where he really gave his life to God. It was closer to 70, I think. I should have checked that. I didn't check it, but it's up in that area someplace. Okay, personality change is what is required. The personality consists, most people tell us, of mind, emotions, and will. So a total change of motivation requires a total change of personality, which means a change of attitude, a change of feeling, and a change of goal involving the whole mind, emotions, and will. So, in these sessions, the three of them, we're going to talk about in the change of mind, change your mind about yourself. Or, a psychologist would say, correct your self-image. The second session, we will say, change your feelings about your work, considering our work as a platform, as Christians, for something beyond it. And then in the will, change your goals to fit your personal value system. In the third session, we will talk about how to identify your personal value system. We got a little checkoff list for doing that. Now, the question comes up, is what we're talking about here scriptural? Very much so. Romans 12:3 says, the Phillips translation, have a sane estimate of your capabilities. Is that the same thing we said before about a self-image? According to Dr. Maxwell Maltz, the discovery of self-image, he says, is the most important psychological discovery of this century. But it isn't exactly something new. It goes back as far as the Bible. Now, the Living Letters translates that same verse just a little bit different. And it says, be honest in your estimate of your abilities. So what we're saying here, that we need to change our mind about ourselves in order to have a correct self-image. And before going any further, we probably better define this a little more clearly. I'm going to give about four sentences on self-image and then ask two or three of you to put it in your own words. You do that? It's a nice classroom size here. The most important psychologic discovery of this century is the discovery of the self-image. Self-image is our own conception of the sort of person I am. It has been built upon our own beliefs about ourselves. A human being always acts and feels and performs in accordance with what he imagines to be true about himself and his environment. So, somebody put it in your own words. Now, what is self-concept or self-image?
It's the way we look at ourselves subjectively.
Objectively or subjectively? Okay, somebody else want to put it a little differently? Yes?
The way we view ourselves.
Okay, anybody else? I'll give it a try. Yes?
We are what we think we are.
Okay. If we put these together, I think what we're saying is that my self-image, my self-concept, is my conclusion or idea about the kind of a person I am. Is that all right? Do we know what we're talking about? Okay. I'm not up with myself. How our self-image is formed. Now, this is very important. Our self-image is a result of our interpretation of other people's reaction to us. Now, let's use some extreme examples here. Do you know somebody who thinks they're a great guitar player and who really isn't? Or somebody who's a great vocalist? Now, if through politeness, every time a person plays a guitar or sings, everybody very politely, then, oh, that was great. That was wonderful. What is that person going to eventually become to believe? A good guitar player. So, that's the interpretation of other people's reaction. One of our fellows once up in Washington gave me a little sheet out of a course he had had in this. The professor, at the beginning of the term, started looking out for the funny man in the class, joke teller. Somebody, you know, always had the latest and the good one. So he got together with the rest of the students, and they decided that from now on, we will never respond No, never laugh at anything this man says from now on. So, you know what? Within less than a month, he had stopped telling jokes. Totally. Because his interpretation of their reaction was that he wasn't funny anymore. Now, he didn't know whether he had lost his ability to distinguish what was funny or whether he missed a punchline or just what. But he quit behaving like that. Their reaction changed his behavior totally. So I say this is very important, that our self-image is a result of our interpretation of other people's reactions to us. Now, this often starts out in the home. Most new couples are not ready, they're not equipped when their first child is born. You know, it's just impossible. It's quite an experience, you know, to have the little tyrant move in, takes over, control the household. And most parents are not imaginative to always think up when the child gets old enough, you know, to get into everything, to think of an alternative suggestion for what the child should do. But don't do this. Now stay out of this. One mother was heard to give her babysitter the instruction at every 10 minutes, open the door and yell, "Johnny, stop doing that." So, in an extreme case, the first reaction of the child is, "I can't seem to do anything right. I can't seem to please anybody." Then, if he's involved with playmates that have a little more imaginative parents, they detect in a hurry. He's kind of slow. So he becomes a brunt of their jokes. You know, they're always the last man. Now, by the time he starts at school, he wonders, you know, if he can do anything right. Well, the teacher can pick this up in a hurry. She just assumes that he's the dullest one in class. So she begins to treat him that way. So although this young man may have a high IQ and be very brilliant, he has a maladjusted personality because of his interpretation of other people's reactions. He's not really dumb and stupid. But he's decided that it is because of his interpretation of other people's reactions to him. Now, two or three cases on this. We had a fellow who's not on the staff anymore, but he served with us for 8 or 10 years. I was with him in a training program one summer for a couple of weeks. Not that long, but the program had been going a couple of weeks. So I commended him on the program. I said, you know, this is one of the greatest. He said, "Grace of God." And I said, "Well, that's true. And he has used you in this." He said, "Pure coincidence." Well, I had that reaction from so many times, and I said, "Now, this is time to do something about it." I said, "When somebody tries to commend you, why do you always push it off and turn it down? You never accept a compliment as though you did anything right." And he said, "Well, he couldn't do anything right." So I said, "Now, let me expound a theory. Now, I don't know anything about your background, but your father was a real tyrant, wasn't he?" Looked, you know. "How did you know?" And then he began to tell me that in all of his life, his dad had never done anything except tell him how worthless and stupid that he was. So we talked about it. He had a very negative personality. And he recognized it. and that it hindered his effectiveness as a Christian and as a rep. And he said, well, I've been about 32 years getting into this. Is there any way I can get out? I said, well, fortunately, there is. And I'm going to jump ahead here, then we'll come back and repeat this a little later. And I said, now, the average person's brain accommodates about 10,000 thoughts a day. Now, in the 32 years you've been living, how many of those do you suppose have been negative, untrue, about yourself? Well, he thought it was quite a few. And that he said, have I got to go another 32 years to get rid of these? And I said, well, fortunately, not. How do you get rid of them? And I said, I'm jumping ahead. I'll come back to Scripture on this a little bit. So I said, you ever have your battery run down on your car? Yeah. You know what happened? Well, he wasn't too much of a technician, so he really didn't. I said, well, really what happened, if you leave your lights on, all of the negative charges on the battery go through the filament over to the positive plates, and they're all lodged over there. So you turn on the switch, nothing happens, because there's no flow. All the negative moved over to the positive. Now you say, well, I'm going to correct that. I'll go down and get my battery charged. So what you do when you go to the service station, there's a battery charger. All it is a reversed current in the thing. Throw that on the battery. And that positive thing, side, is bombarded with such a heavy volume of positive charges that it forces the negative charges back over on their own plates. Then you say your battery's charged up again. Well, the only way that negative can be counteracted is by an equal volume of positive. I'll explain the scripture on that in a little bit. Now, this is God's method of overcoming a negative personality. I've wondered sometimes what happens in regeneration. If you have poor eyesight when you're born again, is it corrected? You have bad teeth? Corrected? Now, regeneration doesn't touch these things. Mainly, we change our attitude about God, or He changes it, and we establish a new value system. But if a person has an obnoxious personality when they're converted, it is not automatically cured through regeneration. Now, naturally, a person has more positive things in their lives than before, so there's some improvement. And the person is, a little more bearable. You live with them a little better because there are some positive aspects. But a negative personality is not automatically cured when a person becomes a Christian. Now let's approach it another way. I was responsible for a ship for some 2.5 years while I was in the Navy. As I look back on that 2.5 years, it's very humorous, parts of it. The captain of a ship has an obsession that he works on 24 hours a day. You know what that is? Keep water underneath. And he never trusts anything. You don't trust a chart. You don't trust channel buoy markers. You don't trust a sonar machine. And when the wind's blowing, you don't trust the anchor. If you're moored, you don't trust the mooring lines. You're always afraid something's going to happen, that thing's going to go aground. And I wonder how many nights I stayed up all night just because I didn't trust anything or anybody, but I didn't. That's the height of disgrace, to get not have water under it. Now, occasionally, in spite of all the care that we exercise, a ship does go aground. And there's a rule that every captain is familiar with. Now, here's the land. Here's the deep water out here. If you have the misfortune to run the ship aground, how is the easiest way to get off? It's always to reverse the course exactly, because the ship dug a little hole in the mud when it went up here. Any other way you go, it's going to be worse. So you try to back it off exactly the same direction you went on. That makes sense, doesn't it? So in the matter of the negative personality, the cure is to reverse the process by which it happened. So I see we're getting details a little bit. Did you ever see an elephant in a circus with a little chain around his ankle and a little peg driven in the ground? When an elephant is young, they tie him up with a powerful chain to a powerful post in the ground. And he'll struggle, pull, do everything he can to get loose. One day, he finds out that he can't, and he gives up. From that time on, you can put a kite string around his foot and tie him to a toothpick, and he'll never wander off, because he has decided now that he's bound from now on with that. An experiment I read about, it was an interesting one, was the barracuda. They put in a tank with a bunch of mackerel, and he was pretty hungry. But they had a glass partition in the pool. So when they put him in, he backed off, took a run, and really bruised himself as he bounced off that glass. So they left him in there, hungry, and he made another run, this time a little easier. But no matter how hungry he got, pretty soon he came up, he'd make a run, and then he'd turn around. And he'd never hit that pane of glass. Then they took the pane of glass out. And what happened? He'd back off and make a run. But as far as he was concerned, it was still there. And he never crossed the boundary where that thing had been. So our self-image is not exactly accurate. This is what we find in research on this. There's all kinds of imaginary things, you know, that we think are there that are not. Okay, we're going to go a little more now as to how the self-image is formed. Now, this is a terrific verse. Unfortunately, the Revised really misses a point in this, the RSV. But the Amplified, it brings out what it really says, I think. King James says, "A man thinks in his heart, so is he." This is a tremendous scriptural and psychological truth. As a person thinks, that's the way they become. See, somebody mentioned that, didn't it? Here, in the beginning. Okay. Now, we want to illustrate this process. Dr. Maltz, I've mentioned him a time or two, was a plastic surgeon. And he was very, very skilled. In fact, he could correct a major deformity and not even leave a hairline scar after having corrected that deformity. But you know what he found? After he had corrected a person's too large a nose or too large a ears or some other defect, the person acted just like they did before. You know, they had been so used to thinking that people rejected him because of that physical problem. After it's removed, they went right ahead and never acted any different. So he said that what's needed is personality surgery to complement the cosmetic surgery. We've got to, after we've removed the cause, we've got to see a person's behavior changed. So he went from being a cosmetic surgeon to a psychologist and discovered some things that had never been discovered before. In investigating every possible area, one of the things he went into was hypnotism. And to his amazement, found out that there were cases on history, cases on record, where that a good hypnotic subject could be handed a cold iron poker that had been shaded with chalk so it looked like it was red hot. Place that on the hypnotic subject's hand, and a blister would rise up under it. And he said, "Now, what in the world goes?" Well, he didn't have all the answers, but I think I've got the answers to this. Now, what happens if you put a hot poker on your palm of your hand? Well, the first thing that happens is the nerves pick it up, and they send a message to the brain. Tissue is being destroyed. And the brain sends an order to the body chemistry for the bloodstream to race some water, cool it off. And the bloodstream regurgitates some water, and it comes so fast that it stretches the skin right there, you know, almost instantly. Builds a little cover over it with some water in there to cool it off. Now, here is the important thing. The body chemistry does not evaluate communication from the brain as to whether it is true or false. All it does is identify the source. If the brain says tissue is being destroyed, the bloodstream rushes water, even though tissue is not being destroyed. See what I mean? The body chemistry and nervous system reacts to the brain, whether the brain is right or wrong, and does not have the power to evaluate any message that comes from the brain. So if the brain says you're stupid, what does the body chemistry say? Act stupid. Do something stupid. It is well known that a person who thinks that they can't do something doesn't have a chance of succeeding in that particular project. Is that right? Now, on the other hand, Paul said, "I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me." That's a mobilization order. The brain's mobilization order to the nervous system and chemistry of the body is mobilize all your resources. While when the brain says, "I can't," that is a surrender order. Lay down on the job. Now, we want to suggest here, naturally, that this law operates within limits. And that's the limits of cause and effect. I probably could not command my nervous system and bloodstream to mobilize the energy to lift 1,000 pounds. So there are limitations, you know, cause and effect limitations. But within the law, the limits of the laws of cause and effect, these things go on. Now, does this throw light on the scripture, Proverbs 23:7? As a person thinks in his heart, So he becomes. Whatever we think we are, the nervous system, body chemistry, starts creating that kind of a person. Well, I think we ought to have a little reaction on Proverbs 23:7. Now, that's in the Bible. Is that true? That a person becomes what they think. Yeah, that's what the scripture says. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. If you think negatively, what kind of a person do you become? A negative person. Now, I don't want to Norman Vincent Peale us here and talk about thinking positively, but I do want to talk about the truth. We're not talking about positive and negative charges. We're talking about the truth versus lies. According to one authority on this subject, 95% of all persons have their lives blighted by feelings of inferiority to some extent. And to millions, this same feeling of inferiority is a serious handicap to success and happiness. Feelings of inferiority originate not so much from facts or experiences, but our conclusions regarding facts and our evaluation of experiences. There are about 95% of people that feel inferior, and many of them, as he pointed out, this has a tragic effect on their whole life. Now, there are about 5% that have too high an estimate of themselves. God has a way of taking care of those. Now, people ask me sometimes, how do you deal with somebody that's has pride? And you don't have to. God is so interested in that that he takes care of that himself. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. God will take care of pride in Christians. He just wrote one verse about this, you know, about people that think too highly of themselves. But a whole chapter, 1 Corinthians 12, about people that feel inferior and unworthy. This is the chapter, 1 Corinthians 12, about the body, where that the foot says, I'm not a part of the body because I'm not a hand. You know, the foot feels inferior to the hand. And the ear says, I'm not a part of the body because I'm only an ear, not an eye. The ear feels inferior to the eye, and the foot feels inferior to the hand, and this whole chapter deals with this subject. Probably, your self-image and mine is less than 50% accurate. And I think I wouldn't be wrong in saying that it's less than 10% accurate. About 90% of it is wrong. Well, how do we do something about it? What we've got to do is to find out the truth about ourselves. Now, there's three ways we can do this. John 17:17, Christ answered Pilate's question that he'd asked earlier, what is truth? And John 17:17, Christ said, thy word is truth. So the reason that a Christian has something going for them is because they begin to believe some of the Bible, some of the truth about themselves. And I could go for a whole hour on this. I spoke to the Wisconsin group yesterday about the greatness of God and the greatness of his interest in you. And, you know, we talked about Psalm 139, where that every person has a different formula, different set of genes and chromosomes. A genetic student in Australia told me that they'd figured out that before God duplicated, he had a range
of 3 billion to the 30th power of possible genes and chromosome combinations. God has never used any same formula twice, never will. Let me read something else. The truth about you is this. You are not inferior. You are not superior. You are simply you. You as a personality are not in competition with any other personality simply because there is not another person on the face of the earth like you. Or in your particular class. You are an individual. You are unique. You are not like any other person and never can become like any other person. You're not supposed to be like any other person, and no other person is supposed to be like you. God did not create a standard person and in some way label that person by saying that is it. He made every human being individual and unique just as he made every snowflake individual and unique. God created short people and tall people, large people, small people, skinny people, fat people, black, yellow, red, white, and I was going to say purple, but it says red and white people. He has never indicated any preference for any one size, shape, or color. Abraham Lincoln once said, God must have loved the common people, for he made so many of them. He was wrong. There is no common man, no standardized common pattern. He would have been near the truth had he said, God must have loved uncommon people, for he made so many of them. So, we've got to believe the scripture on this, which we won't go into, that God made each of us for a specific purpose, and the only thing we've got to do to please him is to find out what that purpose is and then get with it. But we're not in competition with anybody. Now, John 4:36, Christ said, if the Son therefore shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. By the power of Christ and the power of the Holy Spirit, transformations do take place. But this is not the usual pattern. Christ further said in that same paragraph, John 4:32, you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Probably 90% of all personality changes that come about are the result of truth that comes from people on whose lives your personality has had some kind of an impact. Well, to be real crude here, if you have bad breath and it's offensive to people, will you ever find about that in the Bible? Do you think as you pray, God will reveal it to you? How are you going to find out? It will be from a person on whose life your personality has had an impact, positive or negative. This is really the solution. Now, I don't know when I began to study this, 6 or 7 years ago, I guess. I came to the conclusion that what my need was at the time was not more knowledge, and it was not more experience, because I had accumulated a little bit of experience and some knowledge, I hope, down through the years. That wasn't what I needed. What I needed was a change of motivation, which would allow me to more effectively use my knowledge and experience. So I went to work on it. I attended a 3-day seminar in the University of Wisconsin. I paid $400 for a special course, and I paid 95 cents for a book. And the 95-cent book, was worth 90%. You know, it had as much as, I got 90% of all I learned out of it, and only 10% out of the trip to Wisconsin and the $400 set of cassettes. But the first conclusion at which I arrived was that everybody has a degree of error in their self-concept or self-image, except me. Because as I studied this, I could see in most everybody I knew that there were certain areas here where this person had a totally wrong concept about what kind of a person they were. But as I looked over the evidence, I said, now, according to the evidence, I also have some areas of false concept. And I'd concluded, well, there's one way to find out. So I was leaving for a trip overseas. And about two or three days before that, I asked the three people that I work the closest with if they would write down on a list what they considered were my major deficiencies, and if I had anything positive, what they considered that was. Now, they were very reluctant to do this. And what do you mean? You know, you're honest or dishonest? So that's a part of it. Oh, by the way, I'll come back to that. I said there's three areas in which I'm concerned. The area of my personality, my gifts, and my character. See, honesty, that's just one of them, you know. Yeah, you're honest, well, that's character. I said, I'd like you to write down what you consider are my major deficiencies and any positive things in these three areas, personality, gifts, and character. Well, I say they were very reluctant to do so. And they didn't want to be identified, even though my closest friends. So I said, well, will you do this then? Will you write it down on a piece of 3x5, and then we'll shuffle it and give it to Millie. And she'll mix them up, and then she'll write it on a sheet of paper and give it to me. So just before I left to go to the airport, she gave me the sheet. And they had put up the top, you know, some positive things, but being the kind of people we are, you know, I didn't even look at that. Yeah, I looked the bunk on the way home, and my first reaction, now what's the matter with these people? In Matthew 7, 1 through 5, he says, judge not, that you be not judged. Then he goes on to say that it is very common for a person who has a 2x4 in their eye to mistake this for a toothpick in somebody else's eye. Now that's what he's talking about. So naturally a person, in evaluating another person, uses himself as a point of reference. Now, if a person is an extreme introvert and you're just normal, that person will say, too outgoing, too much of an extrovert. Because see, what they're using is a point of reference. And you know, I took a look at that list, and each guy might as well have initialed after, because I could identify every one of them in there. Now, realizing that in some cases, they were talking about themselves more than me, I said, well, I'm going to throw out everything except the ones on which they are unanimous. But where the same thing appears three times, both on the negative and the positive, then I better take that serious. Because these people, you know, they know me, they love me, they're my friends, and they're telling the truth. A little while before that, I'd taken a half day alone and wrote down in my notebook in two columns. One, what I thought my major deficiencies were, And then a small list on the other side of some positive things I thought God could use that he'd given me. And I didn't know what I was doing at the time, but really what I was doing was writing down my concept of the kind of a person I am. So I took out their list, took mine, the ones in which they were unanimous, and compared them. And I had one of the shocks of my life. I found that my number one that I had over here, three times, is over here. And the top two that I had over here showed up. Three times, each one of them, the other side. Now, I had to make a decision. Who's right? Who's wrong? Well, the only honest conclusion I could arrive at is, now, these people know me, they love me, they're objective. They must be telling the truth. I'm the one that cannot accurately evaluate. So you know what I did? I took this thing over here and I placed it in retirement. And I trotted out of retirement these two things and said, now I think I'll try using what they say is a positive gift, an ability I have. And you know what happened? The reaction that I got was exactly the way they said it was. Things in which I felt insecure and inferior, I found that when I started using them, great positive response. And I think several people were relieved when I retired this one. But I was honestly mistaken. Now, Lauren and I having worked on it, he was one of the evaluators of the three, we decided that the DDs should do this at the next DD meeting. So he announced on Monday, you know, we're going to do this on Wednesday. And from Monday and Tuesday, it was a total waste. We couldn't get any business done for people thinking about what was going to happen. So, 11 o'clock Wednesday, we got together, and there were eight of us. So, every person wrote down, I think we said three positive, one negative, on the other seven. Well, you come up with quite a long list, you know, from seven other people. And we got together for the afternoon meeting, and Lauren said, now, these things are not identified, but if anybody here has a question, you just say, now, somebody said this, and I'd like more light on it. You know, could I see you privately expand on it? And nothing happened. Not a word happened in the meeting. So Lauren went through his, and he said, you know, this is what you say. And he took it very serious, and then he couldn't get any response. And he called on me involuntarily to kind of go through mine, and so I kind of went through mine. And he kept trying to get some reaction out of the other people. So finally, Skip Gray spoke up, and he said, what all I know is who doesn't know how to spell knucklehead? And one fellow said, if this is what you guys think of me, I'm quitting right now. And another guy, now if this is what you thought all along, how long I've never found out about it. And there were three of them that it was a very traumatic experience. Well, that DD week, it was a waste, I'll tell you that. And Lauren and I knew this was going to be, a serious experiment. We didn't realize how serious it was going to be.
So we skipped that for a while. Then, 2 years later, 1972, three more were added to the group. There were 11 of us. Got together on the Pink House lawn, and each of us related what we felt was the greatest need in the Navigators and how we could best fit into that greatest need. You know, that was kind of saying what we thought we could contribute. It was interesting to me to hear these three fellows that had been such a traumatic experience 2 years before stand up and say, well, according to you fellows, my greatest contribution is. Now, I'm not going to tell you who those three are, but I tell you their lives have been transformed because they have been exercising the gifts that their peer group felt were their greatest strengths. Now, instead of a man getting up and saying, now, here's my greatest contribution, he said, well, according to you fellows, my greatest contribution is this. And those three guys are living today in the realm of what these other people told them. They changed their self-image, their self-concept, to a true self-concept. So, let's just mention one other thing here, and then we will take a minute or two for questions and comments. Never watched Gunsmoke? Any Gunsmoke fans here? Okay. Kurt, let's suppose that James Arness, his manager, found out you were a fan of his. So he sent you an invitation to come out to Hollywood, have dinner with James Arness. So, great. So you rush out and go up to his house, and James Arness comes to the door, lets you in, and said, come and be seated. We'll have dinner in just a few minutes. So he rushes in the bedroom, puts on his Matt Dillon suit, and comes out, and you sit down at the table. And all he does is act like Matt Dillon all night, you know, Dodge City. How would you feel after an evening like that? I think I would feel greatly disappointed. Because you didn't come there to talk to Matt Dillon. You saw him on TV. You wondered what James Arness as a person was like. But he never let it be known. He masqueraded as Matt Dillon, pretended he was Matt Dillon all evening. So the person was an inaccurate self-image. To the degree it's inaccurate is masquerading and withholding true identity and worth from the people in touch with. Now, can you see how a person can have a change of motivation by discovering who they are and then start manifesting their God-given personality through this avenue of the gifts and the strengths of the true person that they are? A person can really get turned on. And even at my age, I really got turned on when I trotted out these two areas in which I had felt insecure all my life. And I really got excited about some things. So, our first session on motivation involves change your mind about yourself. Correct your self-image. What you're doing is just shifting that motive power that may be being misdirected into a fulfilling, positive, rewarding experience to yourself and others. So the first step in a change of motivation, change your mind about yourself, correct your self-image. Our next session, which will be 2 weeks this morning, we get into change your feelings about your work. We get into the realm of the second aspect of personality, the emotion, the feelings.
A lot of actions that we do or not do are motivated by feelings. So we're going to try to straighten out the feelings, just like we've tried to think out the thinking process today. And then the third, we talk about the will. I'm leaving tonight from Georgia and going directly from Atlanta on Sunday to Los Angeles for the NAE-EFMA convention and an annual dinner in San Diego next Thursday night. So I can't work in the session very well without a few extra miles. So Bob Potter has asked that my wife meet with you next Thursday morning. So she'll be with you next Thursday morning. And if you have any subject you'd like for her to talk about, well, give her a buzz, because she doesn't have a subject at this point. Okay, is there any question or comment on this session? Bob?
Jim, would it be a correct understanding of what you said this morning, that the only way we can find out, the only way we can do something about what you told us about this morning is to have our friends evaluate?
Now, I think that's what the Scripture says. You should know the truth. The truth will make you free. Now, where are you going to get the truth? Well, you can get some out of the Bible. You can get some directly. He said the Son will make you free. But I say 99% is you find out the truth about yourself. And I have said the best source, the only source, are the persons on whose lives you've had an impact, good or bad. They're the only ones that know, aren't they? If somebody doesn't know you, can't help you. And I said two or three times here that there are three qualifications to be the person that can help you. And that is, must know you, must love you, and must have the courage to be objective. This NAV rep I was talking about, I said, did Lauren Sanney ever tell you that you did a good job? He said, oh, yes. Then why don't you tell him he's either a liar or stupid? He said, well, I'd never do that. I said, you already have. Because he said you did a good job. You said you didn't. You said he's either a liar or a poor observer. You know, if the person loves you, knows you, has the courage to be objective, you better take serious what they say. Now, I modify that to say where there is a consensus, to where it is evident that the person is not using their own weakness, comparing you with their own weakness. But where there's a consensus, better take it serious. Any other question or comment?
I get the impression, hearing this, that Philippians 2, 3, and 4, where humility comes important, not for you to judge what the truth is from this other person. There is, we have to accept, like, the person says we're strong and where you feel weak, then we have to be humble enough to exercise that by taking, you know, accepting the consequences of moving ourselves forward in that what they say is a strength. I think that's kind of like you say, if you have an exercise that you think is a weakness, because you think it's a weakness, and then start moving out the weakness, your feelings initially, you know, are kind of somewhat unsettled.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize, you know, just what people say has to be the truth. You know, a lot of people may be mistaken. They might have hang-ups themselves, but you find out what's the truth. And if you get enough people that agree on something, you know, then it's probably right. And Joe, what you say is very true. It is tragic that many people go through life exploiting their greatest weakness instead of their greatest strength. And it is not uncommon for a person to be 180 degrees mistaken about what they are, and to mistake their greatest weakness for their greatest strength. I could give some examples of that in the Navigators, but we won't. Is there any other comment? Yes.
You said you get back to the guy and how you help him. Will that be in the next session?
Yeah, I think I did give him some help. And I set up a program, first of all, where he would believe what the Bible said about him as an individual. And then that he had to accept every commendation that he got, and to thank the person that gave it to him. Now, instead of saying, oh, grace of God, pure coincidence, you know, thank you. And to believe it is truth, and then write me a letter and telling me about all of it. So I set up a program for him, yeah. Well, the clock says our time is over, so I'll see you 2 weeks from this morning.